countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal, bringing 295,000 readers the latest farming news and the best of rural Ireland weekly.
Now on RTE Radio 1, time for Countrywide with Marty Morrissey.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal, bringing 295,000 readers the latest farming news and the best of rural Ireland weekly.
Good morning and welcome. I'm Marty Morrissey, and between now and 9 o'clock, we go fishing in Loch Neagh, we go swimming on Curraghclough Beach in County Wexford, and we find out how a young man from County Kerry is waiting to cycle home from New Zealand. But first, Galway sheep are a very special breed of lowland sheep that used to be common across the country. They have a flock book going back to the 1920s, and farmers who keep these sheep value them as they are both good for meat and indeed for wool. Blanid Gallagher and her husband Niall are newcomers to farming. Blanid was gifted a farm by her uncle, and she is slowly building her own flock of Galway girls, as she calls them. But she's also brought a lifetime of business experience to the newly formed Galway Wool Co-op, who are looking for markets for Galway wool where its quality and texture will be appreciated. I met her on our farm in East Galway.
Good on ya, they're in here now.
I'm following you.
Come on, girls. We've got a celebrity. We've got Marty Morrissey. Yeah, we've got Marty Morrissey here today. Look at Marty. Look how excited they're getting. Look at the jumping. Huh? Do you all know Marty? You do? Of course you do. Good girls.
And today we're weaning. So we're looking at bringing the ewes and the lambs in, and we'll be looking at separating them from their mums. And it can be a stressful time for them. There's one or two of them that would have been born late, and I leave them on a bit longer. Generally from 12 to 14 weeks after they're born, they can be weaned. But for the mums now are starting into a new breeding cycle. The shortening of the days, which believe it or not happens from June onwards, is an indicator to the ewes that it's time to start breeding again. So most flocks, most people will start their breeding programme, or they will be looking at setting up their breeding programme from around about now onwards. Mm. And what we'll have is we'll pick out the ewes that were good to us last spring, the ones that gave us very little problem. And we'll hold on to them, and we'll say, yeah, you're going to have babies again next year, or young lambs. And then what we're going to do is we're going to look at the lambs themselves that were born. So I'll keep those ewe lambs, and I'll probably not breed them this year. I think what I'm going to do is hold on to them, give them a break, and they will breed for me next year.
And then, does that mean you're looking for a suitable ram?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm always looking for a suitable ram, Marty. So what we'll do is we had a loan of a ram last year, but we'll actually go out to the market now this year and we'll look for a good ram. I'll be looking for a ram that will have a nice Galway conformation and who will also have a nice fleece. And when I find him, I let him out to my girls probably around about the end of September, when the evenings are starting to get short and the girls are aware of the fact that it's time to start disco dancing. The ram will arrive and the dancing will start. And please God, we'll have baby lambs here and we might have you back again for the lambing next March.
Tell me about the Galway sheep. How would you describe them? How do they differ from other breeds?
They're indigenous. They're native to Ireland. They're docile. They're excellent mothers. They've gotten a lot of bad press. I remember when I got into them first, the one thing that was said to me, don't bother with those Galways. They'll only give you one lamb. Codswallop. They will give you two lambs. They're very calm. They're very friendly. And for somebody, a novice like myself, getting into sheep for the first time, it was a no-brainer. And then The cream for me was the fact that they are one of the very, very few dual-purpose sheep in Ireland. They are wool producers. The wool from these sheep is the backbone to the Irish craft and textile industry, because these were the sheep that would have been all over Ireland in the 60s and the 70s. So when the Americans and the tourists were coming to Ireland and they were heading off to Shannon and Dublin Airport with their suitcases full of Aran sweaters to bring home, it was the wool from these sheep, Marty. Mm.
The Galway Wool Co-op, to be more precise, is about finding markets for quality Irish Galway wool.
The Galway Wool Co-op was set about because the traditional wool that came from the sheep was bleeding, it was hemorrhaging into the national clip. And as you were aware, and as a lot of your listeners here this morning will be aware, the national clip is in dire straits because of one reason, that is we do not have a marketplace for wool here in Ireland.
Explain how that's working and how's it going so far?
Ah, it's been a dream. We all met each other on Zoom since January of this year, and we'd have the Zoom calls and they'd be, you're on mute, and we'd have, oh, somebody hasn't turned up, and it was new for all of us.
Yeah.
And we had nieces and nephews and sons setting up calls, and Martin Ward is our chairman, Margaret Hegarty is our treasurer, I'm the secretary, and we met once every couple of weeks. And we got a grant from LEADER, Galway Rural Development, very kindly sponsored the virtual side of things. So our co-op will be virtual. There'll be no bricks and mortar. There'll be no head office. What we have is a platform that's been developed by Yum Creative in Carlow. And they actually are going to set up a co-op that the farmer could come to online. People who want to use Galway wool could come about, see the Galway sheep, find out why they're unique. They can experience virtually an experience like you've had today. So whether you're in Dubai or Sydney or New York or Paris or Milan, you'll be able to click into galwaywool.ie and you'll be able to see what is all this fuss about. We're not getting paid for this. We're doing it because we know it's the right thing to do. We need to make people aware. We need to make the consumer aware that most of the wool in your products is imported. It's not actually Irish wool.
Yeah. So how would you like us, on the outside looking in, to view the wool that's produced by the Irish Galway sheep?
Oh, heritage. Think back to your heritage. Think back to the fact that this animal is producing a biofibre, which is, you know, the new buzzword for wool now. It's a biofibre that has many different uses. And, you know, whilst we have all this talking on about climate change and carbon credits and all of that, just remember that wool coming off the Galway sheep is actually holding carbon.
Yeah.
So why are we putting it on a boat and shipping it off to China as waste? When in actual fact we could be putting it into use here in products in Ireland. Again, we're not looking for the clothing or the textile industry to start falling on their knees because Galway wool is suddenly available. Mm. But we're looking at makers and creators to see different uses for the Galway wool. And to say, this is my heritage, this is part of Ireland, this is part of the rural country, this is the fabric of the rural countryside. So why don't we use it? Why don't we actually bring it into our homes, have the circular economy in our homes, in furnishings and fabrics? Home interiors is the place I see for Galway wool.
If we are buying wool products in Ireland, should we be asking for Irish wool?
Absolutely. And you'll get a little bit of, oh, we don't have Irish wool, it's not available. And you'll be able to say, well, I was listening to Marty on a Saturday morning and I heard that Galway wool is available and it is Irish. And it's available from Donegal Yarns from September of this year onwards.
You know, this is your land, Planet. This is your heritage. What do you make of it all for yourself, where you are in life now? And when you look, this is your green fields.
I love it. And I say, you know, I'm blessed. We are blessed. Niall and I both appreciate that this is heaven on earth. Blessed today that the weather is fine. And I can be sure you can hear the rooster in the background, even though he's not nearly half a mile away from us. But we are blessed. And I think a lot of people coming out of the pandemic have reassessed where they are in life. And, you know, anybody that's in a rural area that can have the benefit of being able to walk a rural country lane or just get out in the field or just watch a leaf fall along on a stream. These are all things of nature that are just so gifted to people who are living in rural communities. Mm. You know, when you live in an area where you're just surrounded by concrete and glass and windows and cars and exhausts, and you just say to yourself, you know, what is wealth, Marty? This is wealth. You know, it's not a fiscal value, it's not a bank account. It's been able to have the privilege of the time to be able to enjoy this time with you, time in the country, time in nature. That's true wealth. So I consider myself very privileged, Marty. Yeah, I do. I pinch myself on a daily basis and I say, yeah, I'm privileged. I'm very lucky and I appreciate it. I do.
And indeed, I was lucky to be in East Galway with Blanid for a little while. Really enjoyed my visit. And the sheep did indeed give me a very warm welcome. They ran for miles away. The Galway Wool Co-op is just getting up and running, but you will be able to see the work of the co-ops at galwaywool.ie from the end of August. Now, when COVID struck all those 17 months ago, it was a bit like a children's game of musical statues. You know yourself, the music stops and we stay put exactly where we were. Things have eased considerably since then, but there are probably visitors to Ireland who've ended up spending longer than they thought. And there are still Irish people scattered across the world for longer than they ever imagined. One of those is Tomás McAteer from Ballyfermotshire in County Kerry. He was cycling in New Zealand when COVID struck, and he is still there. He's currently in Methven in New Zealand, trying to figure out how and when he can cycle home. When I caught up with him, he explained to me where this love of cycling started.
But I guess I started cycling when I was about 17, 18, and just immediately just grew to love it, just the freedom it offered me, the sense of adventurement, the sense of, I suppose, looking after myself, being self-sufficient, being self-reliant, and just being able to travel from A to B as quickly or as slowly as I wanted, as often or as little as I wanted. And then, yeah, it just became kind of addictive. And then I realized that not only could I cycle around the beautiful roads of Kerry, but I could cycle abroad. And that led me into cycle touring. And I began to realize that, you know, people could travel on a bike and live off the bike, you know, whether you be camping or staying with local people, you know, you can be completely self-sufficient off the bike, carrying your own camping gear, every little bit of clothing you need, cooking stove so you can cook your own food, you can make your own coffee or tea in the morning. And it quickly just became kind of the lifestyle I preferred. And it's taken me halfway around the world at the moment, and hopefully someday soon I'll be able to continue travelling the rest of the world.
You know, to go from Ballyferriter into Dingle, for me now personally, would be a huge challenge, and indeed to come back. But you went from Egypt to South Africa. That is such a challenge, and in some ways so lonely. Did you find it lonely?
At times, yeah. I think that was one of the biggest struggles with it, because no doubt Africa has a massive population. You know, you're cycling through countries like Egypt, like Ethiopia, where there's just a constant flow of people. But even with that, at times I still felt really lonely. It wasn't home. I wasn't with my, you know, friends I'd grown up with, my family. And I guess the loneliness really hit me when I first hit the desert stretches of the Sahara Desert. And I guess, you know, for the first time in my life, I felt so irrelevant, just this tiny little dot in this gigantic desert that stretches the whole way across Northern Africa. You know, the lack of facilities, the lack of shade was one of the biggest things, because obviously being Irish, we're not used to the 45, 50 degrees Celsius that are just normal in throughout these deserts. And then being in the middle of a desert, there was no phone data, no Wi-Fi. So trying to contact family was proven quite tough as well at the best of times.
Did you ever say to yourself, Tomás, what am I at here in the middle of the Sahara Desert, a Kerryman from Ballyferriter?
Yeah, I definitely do question my sanity at the best of times. But then I also have to remember, you know, why I'm doing it. You know, just the fact that I love traveling. I love that sense of adventure, that sense of devilment, you know, seeking that adrenaline to keep me going.
Did you meet anybody in the Sahara Desert?
There are small little settlements along the way, and people do still live there. People do make a living out of the desert. There were some days where you'd see people with metal detectors looking for gold, still searching, you know, for that elusive pit of gold that would, you know, make them rich and being able to afford a decent living again. And then there was some traffic as well, because people would be driving to and from the border with Egypt. Right. A lot of Sudanese would travel across to Egypt to buy cheaper goods than what they could get in in Sudan. So yeah. I was never truly alone, I guess.
Yeah. Tomas, I've been lucky enough to be in South Africa and to be in a jeep, and you'd see a lion walking by or an elephant. And it is an absolutely wonderful experience. But it's entirely different when you're on your own and you're on a bike. Tell me about the lion.
Yeah, so the first encounter, I was cycling through Mikumi National Park in Tanzania. It's just a 50-kilometer stretch through the national park on the main highway, and I was pedaling along, and I had timed to hit the national park at lunchtime, because that's when it was at its hottest. So it was about 40-45 degrees, but that also meant that the lions would be seeking shade at that stage, because they don't come out during the day when it's too hot. They usually come out between dusk and dawn. So I thought I got away with it. I was pedaling along, and eventually I kind of got hungry and I wanted to stop for a break. I'd stopped at the side of the road, found some shade eventually, and all of a sudden, no more than maybe 20, 30 meters away in the bushes behind me, I could hear the roar of a lion. And the thing with lions is that when they roar like that, it's to scare you, it's to give you a chance to get away. And I didn't need a second warning, so I jumped on my bike as fast as I could and pedaled away, and I didn't look back again.
And did he follow you?
I'm not too sure, Marty. I just kept cycling. I kept cycling, and I was too afraid to look back.
I wouldn't blame
you.
At
that moment, I was saying my goodbyes to my family in my head and friends back at home, and rejoicing in the fact that I was still living my life, and that, you know, if anything were to happen, I'd have a smile on my face, and that's all that mattered at that time.
I have this image of Tomas McIntyre, also known as Speedy Gonzalez, heading off away from the lion, because I'd be doing the very same thing. And how did you find Methven? Is that how you pronounce it, Tomas?
Yeah, Methven, yeah.
Methven.
So basically what happened was, while I was cycling around the North Island, the Irish Embassy and Consulate had posted about me on their various social media pages, and a woman got in contact with me. She'd seen the post about me and then reposted it to this Facebook group called Irish Mammies in New Zealand.
Right.
And she posted about me and said, hey, look, this 26-year-old kid from Ireland is cycling around the country. Can we all help him in any sort of a way? And then all of a sudden I was getting floods of messages from these Irish mammies in New Zealand.
Fantastic.
At that stage, COVID hadn't really impacted much in New Zealand. So I was still cycling, and Methven wasn't on my journey because I was sticking to the coastlines. But then once I realized that New Zealand was going to go into lockdown like the rest of the world, and was at that stage, I decided to reroute and come back to Christchurch to apply for a work visa. And I just so happened to stop off in Methven. And I've been here ever since. I think that was last May.
Wow.
But I've tried to leave numerous times, but it's one of those very charismatic and beautiful little towns with colourful locals. And I immediately just fell in love with the town and fell in love with the people that call it home as well. And yeah, I'm still here almost a year later now.
So, Tomas McIntyre, what's next?
I have a wonderful opportunity to stay on here in New Zealand if I decide to take it. But to be honest, Marty, part of me just can't give up on travelling. I still dream of cycling home to Ireland. So
good man.
I think I'm just going to wait and just continue working, saving money, in the hopes that one day soon COVID will eventually come under control, and, you know, the world will reopen and I can get back to the bike again.
Isn't he just fantastic? That's Tomas McIntyre from Ballyferriter in County Kerry. And good morning indeed to all his family in the kingdom. And if you're one of the thousands of people who bought bikes during the pandemic, be warned, it can be quite addictive and you don't know where you will end up. I love my bike myself, I have to say, at weekends when I do get a chance to cycle. We'll be right back.
RTE Radio 1. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal, bringing 295,000 readers the latest farming news and the best of rural Ireland weekly.
Now, welcome back to Countrywide here on RTE Radio 1. Now, we might think that Loch Ness was formed when Ireland's legendary giant Finn McCool scooped up a chunk of earth and tossed it at a Scottish rival. But what is true is that we know more legends than facts about this vast but little-known piece of water in mid-Ulster. This week, our reporter Suzanne Campbell went out on the lake in a guided tour with Anne-Marie Stocker and Gary McErlane of Loch Ness Stories.
From Ballyrunnan Marina there, Suzanne, and we are now just out of Trad Point, which is very close to where we fish from. And this area is one that we're very proud of locally. It's a real haven for wildlife, lots of really rare plant life and flora and fauna, butterflies, you name it. So when people come out on the Loch Ness fishing story with us, really we are operating within Toome Bay the whole time, which is something that shocks them, because whenever they get on Loch Ness and they see water as far as the eye can see, they think it's very big. And then we point out to them on the map that actually all they are seeing is just this top left-hand corner, and then they're stunned by that.
Where Bonna Black waters sweep down to Loch Ness.
Because the size is quite hard to explain to people. Not only the largest loch in Ireland, but it's one of the biggest ones in Europe. Is that right?
That's right. I think by area, it's the third largest in Western Europe, is my understanding.
Loch Ness is a haven for migratory birds, such as terns, and of course, is famous as one of the last eel fisheries in the United Kingdom and Ireland. Gary fishes every morning, catching eels with draft nets, which go to the local co-op first and then are sold into Europe. The eels stay 15 to 20 years on the lake before leaving Loch Ness for the Sargasso Sea off Florida. Pollen is another valuable fish here, with a protected designation of origin from the EU, which is unique in Ireland. And both are dependent for their survival on a humble fly.
It's our own Loch Ness fly. It doesn't bite. In late April, May is whenever you'll see them in abundance. You'll see them flying over above the shoreline here, the trees. In swarms, you'd nearly think there was a fire. It's like smoke billowing up into the sky. That's how many there is. The importance of the Loch Ness fly couldn't be overstated. All our fish in Loch Ness here feed on the fly at every stage of the fly's life, from the bloodworm in the bottom to the pupa stage and its rising. Everybody thinks a fly lives for a day, but the Loch Ness fly here is a year in the making. It's a year under the water, and then, of course, then it rises for a day or a couple of days to breed and then lays eggs back in the loch again, and that's it. The cycle's done.
So most of its life cycle is actually underwater.
It's underwater.
So it's a food source for fish while it's there.
Which is why Loch Ness fish are so high in omega-3 oil content. It's down to that small fly. They have a small oil sac within them. Our fish are feeding on them in abundance. Of course, then they're taking in that oil, and their oil content is much higher. The eels we're fishing for are adult eels. Anything under 14 inches we must put back. But the life cycle of an eel is fascinating, and people just can't fathom that either whenever they hear it. They don't spawn in our waters here in Loch Ness. They leave at Loch Ness, up the River Bann, out into the sea, down the west coast of Ireland, and then across the Atlantic to the Sargasso Sea, just off the coast of Florida, part of the Bermuda Triangle. And like all good stories in the Bermuda Triangle, they seem to disappear, and scientists know nothing or little or nothing about what happens there. They do know they spawn there. Beyond that, then, they don't know at all. And our baby eel then, in the first year and a half of its life, it travels the Gulf Stream. In the second year and a half, it makes its way back to our waters here in Loch Ness. So it's some journey. Like, it's a 6,000 miles, if you think about it, in its life. That's what it'll have to do just to breed and get back here. So it's not short of a miracle, isn't it, just for a fish that size.
Obviously, historically here, there has been a big eel fishery. It's owned by a co-op now. It's the job you do, apart from doing tours, is as an eel fisherman. It went out of ownership of local people for a long time, and it was a struggle to get back. Tell us about that.
It was a struggle to get back, and the fishing community of Loch Ness had to, they had to pull together, but they always were a very close community. And I think that struggle over the past 100 years up until the formation of their cooperative was something that pulled them even tighter still. And they're very protective of their fishery, they're very protective of themselves. But yes, there was a time my ancestors were put off Loch Ness. It's a story within this community that has never been released, if you know what I mean. Mm. So now it's a job that myself and Anne-Marie have to go on to try and do a wee piece of that and tell the history and heritage of fishing and the fishing life on Loch Ness.
for us, the main story that we have to tell, obviously given who we are and what Gary does, is the Lough Neagh fishing story. But there actually are so many fascinating stories associated with Lough Neagh. You know, the story of Christianity and spirituality, the old cross of Arbo, really, really revered place around these shores. Lough Neagh has acted as a source of inspiration for many people over the years. Seamus Heaney wrote a series of poems in 1969, which he called a Lough Neagh sequence, and he dedicated them to the fishermen. You know, somebody of his stature recognised that long ago that what they did was really different and very exceptional, and he chose to write about it and has immortalised it in many ways. There is a very long-standing kind of heritage that goes with so much of it, and it's about, for us at least, trying to raise awareness of all of that and draw people's attention to it.
Have people from the north and even this region found new experiences by coming here? They had never been out in the lake before?
Absolutely. You know, very often when we have had initial inquiries about tours, it's, you know, very understandably, after us all having been cooped up for so long, it's people who just have had a wee notion, especially in the nice weather, they would like a wee run out in a boat.
Yeah.
And that's grand. But then when they come, they've actually got a lot more than they bargained for, because once they begin to hear some of these stories, and for us, we always say that the non-fiction associated with Lough Neagh is far more impressive than any legend, and it has lots of impressive legends too, but the non-fiction is really inspiring. So when they hear some of those stories about its creatures or its people or historical events that it's been at the centre of, they're just in awe and nearly in shock that they haven't known these things beforehand.
Yeah.
So, you know, most of them thankfully leave us saying that they'll definitely be back, and, you know, with nice positive comments. And that's really good, because that's very much at the heart of what we're trying to do, is to make sure that local people too do realise what we all are lucky enough to have on the doorstep.
That was absolutely lovely and most interesting. And of course, that was Anne-Marie Stocker and Gary McAlane of Lough Neagh Stories with our very own Suzanne Campbell. Now, last August, the country was so relieved when two young women, Sarah Feeney and Ellen Glenn, were rescued in Galway Bay after an overnight ordeal which started when their paddleboards drifted out to sea. Will we ever forget it, indeed? But it was a long night in the water for Ellen and Sarah, for their families waiting ashore and for the rescue services combing the bay. And they all recall it in a new RT1 documentary, on one documentary called Miracle in Galway Bay.
Galway Coastal Radio, Rescue 105 on 164.
Shannon Coastal Radio, go ahead.
We're on scene now, we're just coming into the bay, we're going to commence searching. We'll keep you updated throughout, just let you know, conditions are very good here at the moment. Some showers on the roof, but the conditions of the bay seem pretty good. We'll keep you updated throughout, and we'll talk to the lifeboat once we're in a low level environment. Out.
Just after midnight, Ellen sees the helicopter.
It was just like, oh my God, such a commotion, like we just caused so much hassle, you know, in our heads. It was like, as soon as the helicopter comes out, the lights will just light up the whole bay and they'll just spot us.
Her mum, Deirdre, could also see the helicopter in the distance.
Then at one stage, it seemed to be in the one spot for ages. And I was like, oh, and I was going, they're definitely there. It was, you know, hovering steadily, and then moved on, you know, another little bit. And I was like, oh, no, God, so they mustn't have been together. But I definitely thought that the helicopter was in that spot so long that one of them was there.
But it was to be another 12 hours before Sarah and Ellen were found by fishermen Patrick and Morgan Oliver. And you can hear the full documentary on RT Radio 1 at 6 p.m. tomorrow evening. And it is available to podcast now. Sounds riveting, to be honest with you. Now, let's begin our next piece by remembering a very important and emotional moment in my next guest's sporting life. Davy Fitzgerald is one of the most high-profile hurling managers in the country. Until yesterday, he was manager of the Wexford senior hurling team and led them to sweet success in the 2019 Leinster final. It was their first title in 15 years.
This is it, last chance saloon for Kilkenny. Paddy Deegan has put it wide, it's gone wide, and is that it? Is the Bob O'Keefe Cup going to Wexford for the first time in 15 years? Davy Fitz, in the third year of his management, is seconds away from leading Wexford to the Leinster title, and there it is. It's all over. Do you know what? They'll be dancing at the crossroads tonight. Leinster champions for 2019, Wexford.
Yes, indeed. Great to hear the crowds, and great to hear that moment with Wexford winning the Leinster title for the first time in 15 years. Do you remember that day, Davy Fitzgerald?
Marty, that's one of the ones you don't forget. The emotion from people was absolutely incredible. The way it finished, the scenes coming back into Wexford and going through the county was, it's something that lives with you, Marty, and you won't forget it likely, you know?
I mean, it's just remarkable, the passion that there is for hurling, and I know you have it as well. Is it in the soul? Is it in the heart? Where does that incredible... And so many counties have that passion, Wexford obviously being up there at the top of the list.
Yeah, well, I've had it from a young age, from being a young boy. My uncle bring me to Munster finals year after year, watching that great team of the 70s in Clare, and it's instilled in you. I suppose I've been in Waterford. I've played with Clare for so long and managed them. It's been great, but then my little journey in Wexford for a few years was exceptional. They are so passionate down there, and they really, really care about their sport. Mm.
The last 24 hours have given you plenty of time to remember your time, of course, your 5 years as manager of Wexford Hurling. Are there any other highlights? I mean, obviously that's the pinnacle to achieve a provincial title, or indeed go further, but to bring a cup back to the county that you're managing. But were there other highlights for you?
Marty, listen, there was very little silverware in Wexford over the last maybe 16, 17 years, and I suppose, like, to win promotion and get out, they hadn't achieved that in years and didn't look like achieving it. That was massive, to compete with the big counties in Division 1, to win two World Cups. And would you believe, I honestly think probably our best performance was probably this year against Kilkenny. I think we were very unlucky not to get over the line. We probably played as good as I've seen us, and you're a puck of a ball from getting back to Leinster final, like, and having a chance to win it. So there's been a lot of good memories down there, and I'm just very proud to have worked with a brilliant backroom team and an unbelievable team that I got very close to. And I suppose you don't, in management, Marty, you don't get the chance to leave on unreal terms normally. It's normally you have to go, your time is up and they need something else, or they're rushing you out the door. Probably to get 5 years is probably unheard of. It's not too many people get it, except the exceptional Brian Cody and a few of them, you know.
Mm. You announced the decision yesterday to leave the position of hurling manager with the Wexford County side. Why did you come to that decision? Or was it a difficult decision for you?
Listen, I talked to Micheál and our chairman, and Micheál was actually anxious for me to do another year at least if I could.
That's the chairman of the Wexford County Board,
Yeah, he was mad for me to do. And Marty, driving from Clare, as you well know, you head to Dublin quite a lot, Dublin to Clare. Dublin to Wexford is probably an extra journey on different type of roads, and you could be looking from 2 hours 45 to 3 hours, and you're doing that 3 or 4 days a week, maybe leaving home at 1 o'clock and in the day and getting back at 1 at night. It's 12 or 13 hours. It's a long day. And you know what? Like, I just feel the time is right. I'm on good terms with everybody. They're in a good spot. They're really up there competing with any of the top teams. And it's just time. There's only so much you can do, you know. And I found this year particularly tough for a lot of reasons, a lot of different reasons. And I said, you know what? This isn't a bad time. Tough decision, but I kind of knew after the game, Marty. I knew, but I said I'd give it another 10 or 12 days, you know.
You know, yesterday saw the announcement of 40,000 attendees at an All-Ireland semi-final and final. What will that mean for players and fans? And indeed, from your perspective as well, it must be a welcome announcement.
Well, Marty, you have no idea, having supporters at games, what it means. Like, the pandemic has been difficult for everybody. And even when you're playing the games without them, it's not the same. Even having the few nuggets at the start with the 100 or two, and then as we went on the championship, getting a few thousand at it, it means the world, you know. And like, our supporters are great. Even in Wexford, like, okay, you'll always have a few that make a lot of noise, and they're very, very, very minimum. But our supporters are great, and it's great having them at games.
What are you going to do now? I mean, ever since you retired as a player and winning All-Ireland medals with Clare. You've been involved in intercounty management. And I'm sure that Sharon, your wife, will want you to kind of vacuum the carpets and wash the dishes and do something for at home for a change.
Oh, so she's a list of jobs ready.
I have no and fair play to her. Yeah, yeah. So what are you going to do?
I don't know. It's 31 and a half years, I think. 1989, I came on the senior panel, and I've been involved in the senior panel every year since. I don't know. I just know I was down training our under-17s in the club last night. Enjoyed that immensely. So I did. Involved with the senior team. So I'm sure I'll be kept going somewhere. Will I be involved with a county senior team? I don't know, is the answer. I haven't a clue. I don't know what's out there, Marty. I'll just take a small bit of time and see. An opportunity might present itself. It mightn't. I don't know. Whatever's going to come, all I can say to you is I look back at playing and managing, and it's been great, and that, you know. And
I think you deserve your little break, however long that'll be. And I'm sure you'll be back in management shortly as well, because I think the game of hurling needs the Davy Fitzes of this world. Davy, thank you so much for joining us on Countrywide. We'll talk
Matthew,
to you soon.
Could I just say before I go, I see Joe Canning announced during the week, and I just wanted to say, what an unbelievable player.
I agree.
One of the best I've ever seen. And I happen to manage him, you know, and just want to wish Joe all the best, because he's one of the rare ones you ever find out there, you know.
But absolutely.
Thanks for having me on, and have a good weekend to everybody.
You too, and thanks, Davy, and we'll talk to you soon. Now, we're going to stay at Wexford, actually, because the weather is not that promising for the weekend in Wexford beaches. But Brenda Donoghue was lucky enough to be able to take a dip early in the week on Curraghlow Beach. She discovered that Wexford County Council and their access officer, Caroline Horne, have been trying to make their great beaches accessible to all, including wheelchair users. The council have special beach wheelchairs available at 7 beaches in the county, which is fantastic. John Timms at the Surf Shack manages the beach wheelchairs at Curraghlow Beach, and Brenda was there when Gavin Tracy and his daughter Lauren arrived to pick one up.
Hi, good morning. We have the beach wheelchair booked there for 10 o'clock.
Ah, super. It's the right day for it anyway, isn't it?
Fabulous day.
Cool. And who's using it?
My daughter, Lauren. She's just out there in the car.
Oh, this is a really nice part of the job. It's a really great amenity to have down on the beach here. And I think, kids, adults that use it, it really opens up the beach to them and they have a right time. How are you getting on there now, Lauren?
Getting on good, yeah.
Nelly, we brought the chair over to you here now. Are you ready to get into it?
Yeah, I can't wait.
We'll get the life jacket there then for you. And so, Lauren, look, sure, I know you've used the chair here before now, but you see, you've the two harnesses, one around the waist and then one for up around your chest. So if you're going into the water, we'd like you to use those as well, along with the life jacket, just so you're extra safe in the chair, all right?
Yeah, that's grand.
Has there been a lot of inquiries for the beach wheelchair?
It's been booked out about 2-3 times a day, and I'd say we've had probably twice that in inquiries for it down on the beach. So it's definitely being used there since the middle of June. It's been used absolutely loads.
And we're off. We are on the way to the beach, Lauren, and Dad, of course, is pushing you. Nice job.
Yeah, I like going in the water during the summer with my family.
And what do you like about it?
It doesn't require much of my legs. I can use my arms as well, so it's not as much pressure on my legs. I have cerebral palsy, which affects my ability to walk, so it's very hard for me to get up on the beach, walking up, so we use the beach wheelchair. It's much handier.
Yeah.
Before that, basically, I'd be down the wheelchair or my dad be carrying, and we've been trying to bring all the towels down and everything that we need for the beach. So it kind of put the whole family off the beach because it was so hard to get everything down there at once.
Yeah.
So we'd have to, before the beach wheelchair, we'd have to go up and go back down, which is very inconvenient for us, so it kind of put us off the beach altogether.
Yeah.
As you can see, when we left the car park there, we came up over the boardwalk, and the beauty about the beach wheelchair is it's effortless to manoeuvre. Lauren, she's nearly 13 now, I can't carry her on my shoulders anymore. And her standard wheelchair, I suppose, the wheels are designed for the wheelchair to move easy, and the tyres are very skinny. You could compare them to a racer bike. And as soon as we hit the sand, we're stuck. The beach wheelchair, I suppose you can describe the wheels, they're like balloons. They're full of air. Effortlessly, I got her onto the beach. And now shortly, we're going to wheel the wheelchair into the water. The wheelchair will float with Lauren in the wheelchair. And then after some encouragement, she's going to get tipped over and into the water with her life jacket on. And then she won't come out of the water because she loves it.
Tell me about how you deal with life with cerebral palsy.
Loads of people say to me, how do I deal with it as well? But I just say that it's all I've really ever known.
When we discovered she had cerebral palsy, obviously it was devastating to us. She was 3 at the time. She also had a pacemaker fitted at 3 years of age. She has a heart condition as well. So we just felt we were getting everything thrown at us. Mm. But as Lauren has matured and developed into the person she is now, she keeps us motivated and doesn't let anything stop her. She's horse riding, she's on the beach with the wheelchair, she's in the sea swimming, and Lauren is very positive and she doesn't look at what she can't do, it's all about what she can do, and she's just an amazing young woman. Breaks your heart as a parent because we're feeling our own emotions because we are trying to envisage what Lauren should be doing and looking at what she is doing and what she's not able to do. But Lauren has this great positive attitude where she doesn't think about what she can't do, it's all about what she can do. As we go along, when we see Lauren happy, we know when she's happy, we know when she's sad. She tells us how she feels now, and it's great to see that she can enjoy things like everyone else.
We're coming towards sea. What do you like to do on the beach?
I like going swimming with my dad. My dad used to be a scuba diver, so he taught me everything about the sea.
Yeah.
And I used to actually be afraid to go swimming. And my dad taught me how to face my fear, and I've loved it ever since.
We are at the edge of the sea, about to go in. How excited are you, Lauren?
I'm really excited, just a little nervous about the cold water.
And Dad, you're ready to explain the process?
Well, we get the wheelchair into the water first. Lauren's brother Brandon holds onto the wheelchair just for a bit of stability, and then we're going to tip Lauren into the water.
Oh no. Don't splash me, Lauren.
I won't.
It's refreshing, trust me.
Okay, will we go in?
Yeah.
Okay.
We're basically going into the water right now, and when it gets high enough, I'm going to basically jump in.
Oh, so it's cold. Cold.
We'll try and go in as deep as we can get Lauren so that she's waist deep in the water.
Yeah.
So then the life jacket takes the weight bearing off her legs and she can move freely. Are you ready? So Lauren's going to get tipped into the water. Ready? Up you go.
Who's that? It's cold. Feels refreshing but it's freezing.
My turn. Oh, nice.
It's cold. I'm floating in the water and I'm loving it.
Yeah, so Lauren's now swimming. We're going to do the Superman splash.
No, Dad, don't do the Superman.
Oh, we have to do the Superman splash. You ready?
Oh, I love that report, and well done to Gavin Tracy and his daughter Lauren. And for more details of beach wheelchairs around the coast, go to their website on disability-federation.ie. That's all we've time for this morning. Brian Moss was our broadcasting coordinator. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound. The programme was produced by Martina McGlenn. And next up after the news is Playback. I'm back on the radio here on Monday morning from 9 to 11, so I hope you'll join me. While Brenda Dunhoe and Ella McSweeney will be with you here on Countrywide for the next few weeks, so please make sure to join them on Saturday mornings. From all of us on the Countrywide team, have a great weekend.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal, bringing 295,000 readers the latest farming news and the best of rural Ireland weekly.